Welcome to Race and Democracy, a podcast on the intersection between race, democracy, public policy, social justice, and citizenship. This afternoon, I'm pleased to be in conversation with Dr. Michael Samanga, who is a dear friend and mentor, and a profound scholar, activist, writer, who teaches Africana Studies at Morehouse College, is a former publisher of Third World Press, the legendary Third World Press, and is now the current editor-in-chief of the Black Scholar, one of the most important organs for Black intellectual production in the 20th and the 21st century. Professor Michael Samanga, welcome to Race and Democracy.
Thank you for having me here. I'm very excited to be able to have a conversation with you that other people hear.
You know, I've known about your work for over 30 years, and I've taught your really fantastic book, In the Shadow of the Sun. And I taught that at the University of Rhode Island. I taught that at Tufts and other places, Brandeis. And you share in that book really a profound story of the post-war Black radical freedom struggle and the generational interaction of that struggle and the impact, characters like Cottrell Merritt and others, and the impact that that had on multiple generations of Black lives. And I want to use that as an introduction because I want to definitely talk about the 100th anniversary of Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, and this profound moment that we're in 2025 as we're speaking, where there are all these politics of backlash and revanchism and white supremacy and racial terrorism, but also political terrorism and domination against so many different marginalized groups. But it brings me back to In the Shadow of the Sun and, of course, Malcolm X, Brother Malcolm X, Minister Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, the most important political revolutionary of the 20th century, bar none. How has your political activism shaped both your artistry? You're a poet, you're a novelist, you're a scholar, but how has it shaped the way in which you look at the past, 50 years of American and global history so as to form an understanding of what's happening right now?
That's a great question and one that I'm contemplating every day, actually. The period that I became an adult in, there was an emphasis on study as well as action. So, you know, we were in high school reading Fanon and James Baldwin and, of course, the Panthers and Malcolm and people like that. But it became a practice. All the people I know, you are kind of an outlier, I think, because I know people who are, you know, scholars and teachers, but they're not productive like the stuff that you produce. And I'm saying that because that was as much an important part of our activity as demonstrations, running schools, whatever else we were doing. So The Shadow of the Sun was, it was almost serendipitous. I was asleep and I got this line in my head. It was the beginning of the end of the day. It was the first line in the book, right? And so I always have a pen and pad, now I can do it with technology, but so I got up the next day and I said, I don't even know what this means. You know, what is this? Why did this come? And I went to my computer and a year later I had a novel. It was just, I had not planned to write a novel. It's a little bit more tedious than writing poetry and essays.
Oh, it's a beautiful novel.
Well, thank you. And I had a hard time getting it published. And then Hakeem called me up one day. My mother had a copy of the manuscript, and he was in Detroit and visited her. And she said, oh, have you read Michael's novel? And he was like, I didn't even know he had a novel. So he calls me the next day. He said, you got a publisher? And I said, no, I don't. He said, we're going to publish your book for you. And that's how that happened.
And it's so interesting because Third World Press is growing out of that Black power ferment. It's growing out of that Black radical tradition, saying that we have to transform the epistemology of our reality, so it's not just Western civilization. And when we think about epistemology as the philosophical foundations of knowledge and knowledge production, we need Third World Press, we need Drum and Spear Bookstore,
yes,
we need Dudley Randall and Broadside Press and all these different things. And so it's really beautiful that that, and that came out in what year?
97, 98.
Okay.
That, yeah.
And so when we think about In the Shadow of the Sun and the Black Power Ferment, of course, it brings us back to Brother Malcolm X. And I want to talk about Malcolm. February 21st was the 60th anniversary of his assassination. May 19th is going to be the 100th birthday. In certain ways, Malcolm, in contrast to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is somebody who has not, American society and capitalism has not been able to rehabilitate Malcolm. And they've really, even though they've tried to co-opt Malcolm. Mm. And you can discuss, we can talk about the Spike Lee film. What did that mean 30 years ago, 33 years ago now? But, you know, why, and I want to get deep into this, and the Black Scholar is having a whole special issue on Malcolm. And there are really hundreds of different organizations, as we speak, having commemorations around the United States and around the world on Malcolm. So Abdul Al-Kelamat has been spearheading these. His brother who's coming out of the Black Power Ferment, formerly Gerald McWhorter, a radical sociologist who is part of the Chicago Black Power scene and the Chicago Black Art scene, and has done tremendous work on that and been a very, very important figure in Black studies, period. But he's been disseminating a lot of great information about all these different things that are happening in commemoration of Malcolm. Let's discuss that. Why is Malcolm X so important now more than ever on the centennial of his birth? And what do you think, do you think the Black community and different scholars and activists are doing the kind of a good enough job of projecting Malcolm's spirit in these times?
Answer the last question. I don't think we have. And part of what happens in all the classes that I teach, it doesn't matter what the topic is, I always teach Malcolm X. And part of that is because there's a whole generation that doesn't really know who he is. They don't know why he's important. They know that, you know, Malcolm X, he was a Muslim, right? You know, they say stuff like that, but they don't really know Malcolm. So I show them films, they have to do readings, they listen to speeches, and they come out of class like, man, I had no idea. Malcolm has been kept alive by people like you and me and people you just mentioned, you know, across the world, that this is an important moment right now, but he is one of the most important thinkers and activists in our history. That's not to diminish anybody else, but there was nobody like Malcolm in the 20th century. And you and I talked about this before, about the book that I'm working on now, 13 years, you know, that when you think he did all this in 13 years, it's hard to believe. But had it not been for the people who loved Malcolm, both those who were active and conscious and institutional, and those who just loved Malcolm because he was Malcolm on, you know, on the street. He was that cat, just kind of in the way they love Martin, but Malcolm was one of theirs. Mm-hmm. Malcolm had been to prison, you know, he had been on
Detroit Red,
that's right. And so I think that we haven't done as good a job as we should. I think all of us who are teaching have to bring Malcolm into the classroom, which is probably going to get more difficult given the context that we're in now.
But, oh, absolutely.
But we just have to do it. You can't teach our history without Malcolm being a fundamental part of that teaching. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing about Malcolm is he, a genius, obviously, right? It's a brilliant mind. But to come from the streets and the childhood that he came from, and to finally find his mission, pretty much at the end of his life, you know, gives him something unique. It's like Dr. King in one sense, that I'm a preacher. Mm-hmm. I'm a Baptist preacher. But I really wasn't trying to lead the civil rights movement. I was trying to comment on it and have my congregation involved and stuff like that. But I think there are times for people like that, they show up and they are so focused on what they have to do. Both of those people have, in a sense, near the end of their life, both of them 13 years mm-hmm. in terms of their public life, that this is not going to last long. Mm-hmm. I have to do what I have to do now, and without fear and without, you know, concern for whatever else is going to happen. So Malcolm's, he's unique in that the only person besides all of the Pan-African organizations and stuff, but he's the only one who was literally taking this issue of Black self-determination and the Black exploitation in this capitalist system to the United Nations. He had lined everybody up, you know, the emerging nations and those who had won their freedom and radical organizations and stuff. And he was going to do something nobody else had ever done. And people thought about it, but nobody else had ever done it. And I think that part of Malcolm's legacy often gets overlooked. You know, it often stays with him and his fiery speeches.
Absolutely. And that's what I want to drill down into, the global Malcolm X, the mm-hmm. revolutionary Malcolm X, because I think on one level, one of the things we do, Michael, is the scholarship sort of, most of the time, my scholarship does not do this, but it divides Malcolm into sort of different parts where he's less of a holistic person than a part, the young hustler, sort of the propagandist who's duped by Elijah Muhammad for 12 years, and then finally Paul on the road to Damascus and the epiphany in the Hajj, right? Mm-hmm. I think Malcolm is a much more holistic figure than that. So I think that even when we think about Malcolm in the 1950s and fresh out of jail, who's trying to grapple with the Bandung Conference, Afro-Asian Solidarity, Sukarno, 29 different nations representing over a billion people, the Malcolm who looks at Kwame Nkrumah and meets him in Harlem. And we have pictures, 57, 58, 59, who meets up with Sekou Touré before he meets up with them in a more personal, intimate way in 1964. He understands and is skeptical of aspects of Elijah Muhammad and the doctrine of the Nation of Islam. He utilizes the Nation of Islam like we all utilize institutions because it gives you a bigger platform. Mm-hmm. That's why people use higher ed. That's why people are in corporate America. That's why people are in religious organizations. They understand that if they were on their own, their voice would be a lot less powerful, right? And so when we think about Malcolm, the global Malcolm I'd love to talk about is that, you know, you mentioned Pan-Africanism. And just for our listeners, when we think about this idea of Pan-Africanism, this is this idea that goes way, way back. And we're thinking about David Walker. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about Mariah Stewart. We're thinking about Leopold Senghor and Diop and so many different people, right. Chek Anta Diop, John Henrik Clark, mm-hmm. Du Bois, mm-hmm. is this idea that all the descendants from the African continent have a shared history of struggle, mm-hmm. a shared history of struggle. So when we think about Pan-Africanism, Nkrumah talked about a United States of Africa. Nyerere talked about an Africa that was consolidated as well. But it's really more than just the continent. It's saying that the descendants of the continent actually all have a shared history, mm-hmm. right? And in that shared history, they have a shared human dignity and destiny together, right? Mm-hmm. And the high point of that Pan-African consciousness, I would argue, really ranges from the 1950s to the 1970s, the high point. Because the 50s with Nkrumah, who Howard French has a new book coming out in August called The Second Emancipation. Hmm. And I've been reading, it's a brilliant book about Nkrumah and the high tide of global Pan-Africanism. But that book looks at Bill Sutherland. It looks at Bayard Rustin. It looks at so many different Black folks in the United States and Africa who helped Nkrumah. It looks at George Padmore, mm-hmm. right? It looks at all these different people, C.L.R. James, who helped that Pan-African idea. And of course, Du Bois, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, Du Bois. Stokely Carmichael, before he's Kwame Ture. And so let's discuss Malcolm and his vision of Pan-Africanism, because I think it gets it gets short skirted because one thing that Kwame Ture says, and I've written a book on Kwame Ture, he was desperately trying to complete the mission that Malcolm had started. Because I think we don't give Malcolm X enough credit for the three separate trips to Africa that start in 1959. And we don't, no book, and I'm working on something that does this for the last year, but people have not looked at what he did in Africa in a granular way, who he met in Africa. And when you think about it, it's Pan-African, but it's Pan-Arabic, it's Pan-Islamic, it's Third World, and it's also revolutionary human rights all together. And so that's why I think he's so necessary right now because of all the bridge building he does in an age of global polarization and really a rise of autocracy, authoritarianism, fascism, and white supremacy globally, but also locally, especially in places like Texas right now.
Oh, yeah. That actually, I think, is probably one of the most important analysis about Malcolm. He did what nobody else had done. I mean, there had been interactions between African Americans and people in the diaspora in the African continent and stuff. But Malcolm took it to a political level that it had not been on. The whole idea of being in a meeting of the Organization of African Unity and saying, wait a minute, this can be a global, we need a global.
1964. Yeah, July of 64.
That's absolutely right. That just the initiative by himself, you know, to say, we got to connect all these things. His going to Mecca and the Hajj, you know, to shed the religious practice that he had had before and to be a part of a greater community or a larger community. And also just the audacity of Malcolm. You know, it's like, y'all having a meeting of all the black organizations in Africa? I want to come.
But and it's audacity, but also they what's interesting, I love the reciprocal recognition because he's recognized as Black America's prime minister.
Yes.
And I say this in my writings, it's really not unofficial. It's official. It's official. That's why it's not conferred on him by white people.
Right.
It's official.
Right.
It's official. It's right. Africans and black folks across the diaspora confer that title on Malcolm, and that's how he's able to meet with Nkrumah. I've been to the National Archives and have the State Department stuff on this, where he's in these different meetings. He's in meeting with the Kenyan ambassador, William Atwood, meeting with Kenyatta and Tom Maboya and Nkrumah and Shirley Graham Du Bois and Julian Mayfield and Maya Angelou and all these different people. So it was so interesting in a way that I think it would be more difficult now for that to happen in our age of a kind of unearned celebrity, in our age of real political hypocrisy in so many different ways. Mm. But Malcolm is recognized as this prime minister, and he can go into meetings with African revolutionaries because they realize who he is.
Right.
Right.
He's an African revolutionary.
He's an African revolutionary. Right. And remember, Malcolm X is so famous, he helps make Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali famous. That's how famous Malcolm X is.
Right.
And certainly Muhammad Ali becomes this global figure, but we sort of lose track. And that's one of the things I do in this forthcoming book is to look at the power of Malcolm X and the fact that because of that power, he's investigated by the CIA.
Hounded by the FBI.
He's hounded by the FBI, right. New York Police Department.
Yes.
And so it's not even saying it's a conspiracy. It's these folks, of course, are conspiring against him and actively trying to plan his demise every step of the way.
You know, I think you hit all of that right on the head, that this idea of Malcolm X as a prime minister, you know, that not just the head of an organization or this, but people saw him as the representative of black people in the global context. The other thing that I think we need to pay attention to is Malcolm's development in relationship to women.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who wrote this article, but I saw an article that the title was, "Did Malcolm X Hate Women?" And it's like, man, how'd you jump to that conclusion? You know, but I think that it's important to look at the arc.
Absolutely.
And in the last part of his life, almost all of his top advisors are women.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Lynn Shiflett.
Yeah, so many different
Gloria
people. Gloria Richardson.
Yeah.
All of those radical black women, they're mm-hmm. like, come here, let me talk to you. And they talk to him as a peer, but also almost as a son.
Absolutely.
You know, that what you're doing is big stuff, but it's also very, very dangerous stuff.
Vicki Garvin,
yes. Just those women who don't get the same recognition, but did the same thing as the men were doing. Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, these women who are icons in the, of their own. And his meeting with Castro, you know, just the fact that, that Castro would meet with Malcolm in the same way you're talking about the African leaders and stuff, that would be important. That we're here in Harlem, we got to talk to Malcolm X too.
Yeah, September of 1960, yes.
Yes. Yeah, you got all that stuff in your head, man.
He meets with them in the year of Africa, so it's really extraordinary the connections that Malcolm's able to make.
And he probably was going to have a meeting with him already, mm-hmm. but the whole thing of winding up in Harlem was so serendipitous, man. It was awesome that Castro's like, we mountain people, we'll sleep on the ground. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, come to Harlem. You know, we got a hotel for you, the Teresa Hotel. And those kind of things, I think people see the celebrity of it more than how deep the meaning is that somebody like Castro would meet with a Malcolm X, mm-hmm. you know. And it goes back to the way that the world saw him, the rising world of Africa and Asia and other places. It's almost like a plot that was written in terms of he needed to be a Muslim. He needed to be African. You know, he needed to be a scholar. And none of that was planned.
No.
You know, he lived this intense life after he got out of prison where all of that converges. But not for him, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of being a celebrity. Malcolm knew that he was famous, mm-hmm. you know, and he knew that people would treat him a certain kind of way and stuff. But he was very humble, you know, in his way of dealing with people. But just the idea that somebody would have that kind of impact and not have the mainstream media, not have a lot of black people, particularly church, you know, some of the big churches and stuff. On his side, they were like, "No, nah, we're trying to do this, the integration thing." And you're talking about going to the United Nations and all of that. That each of those things that we've been talking about are books. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be just one small thing because his life was so big in that short period of time. Every time I think about that, I go, "Man, I don't even know how you could read all the books you read in 13 years with that kind of pressure on you, you know, and just constantly taking that message out to the people and training people, because we usually see him as an oratory figure that influences people or a writer that influences people. But Malcolm was actually a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And people who studied the Nation of Islam, like yourself, you know that he kind of built the organizational struggle.
Oh, absolutely.
And taught all of those ministers how to be a minister, how to be in the fruit of Islam. And while he was doing all the other stuff, which kind of suggests that he knew the urgency of it early on.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that I don't know how much time I have, so I'm just grinding.
Oh, he's a man on fire. Let's talk about his ideas about dignity, because I think one of the biggest things that for me, Malcolm's conceptually what he contributed is this idea of radical black dignity. And Malcolm defined dignity as something that was God-given, right? And I think part of his disagreement with King and mainstream civil rights activists for many years was this idea that the citizenship they were looking for was merely the external recognition of dignity. And he had a problem with that because mm-hmm. it was so contingent upon white people,
right?
And I think we're living, you know, I've argued that the period we're living in is the third Reconstruction, mm-hmm. and this is the backlash wave. So people who might be listening say, hey, Reconstruction isn't supposed to be all positive. No, Reconstruction is filled with the politics of backlash and white supremacy, what they call redemptionism in the 19th century, right? But Malcolm, what's so interesting about Malcolm's notion of dignity is that Malcolm's notion of dignity is so capacious, and this connects to your analysis about Malcolm and women, is that he keeps adding people to who's going to be in that inclusive community of dignity, including by 1964, white people who have critical consciousness, white people who are willing to recognize the humanity of black people and other people. And that's what he says, right? So he's at Oxford University, December 3rd, 1964, where he gives the speech of his that at the Oxford Union, the debate, and I've been to the Oxford Union, which is actually separate and distinct from Oxford University. You need special permission to get in there, the official debating society. And I've been in the debating hall where he was with Barclay Humphreys and all these folks, and Tariq Ali and others. And what's so interesting is he says in that speech, the Oxford University speech, and the BBC broadcast this, millions of people watch it. It's Malcolm's most watched speech and most listened to speech took place in Oxford, England. That's the irony, right? Not in the United States. And he says, I'm willing to organize with anybody, no matter what their race is, who's willing to change the miserable condition on the face of this earth. Right. And he gets the standing ovation and the whole thing. Right. So it's interesting. And I'd love for you to talk about this idea of dignity, because I think dignity is the key to the 21st century, because it goes beyond these ideas of citizenship, which are really, really anachronistic, because you can't say the only way we can recognize your dignity is through a passport. Because guess what? Not all of us have passports.
Right. Right. The thing about dignity is that it is the action of that has to come if you say humanity. You know, it goes beyond we're all human beings, we're all birthed by women, we're all, you know, these things. My favorite quote of Malcolm is not by any means necessary. It's the front of that line. We declare our right to be a human being. And when I talk to my students about it, I say, so what do you know about Malcolm X? And I said, what's his most famous quote? And they all say, by any means necessary. And we go through this whole thing of, okay, let's read the whole sentence here and see what that means. What is by any means necessary? Why is it necessary to be said? Because what he's saying is that we have to fight for our own dignity. We declare ourselves. We're not waiting on anybody else to tell us who we are. We declare our right to be a human being. And every time I hear his voice saying that, it clarifies almost everything for me, that what we're trying to do is to, as you mentioned Malcolm's statement at Oxford, that we want the whole world to be different, not just Harlem, not just Detroit, not just London or Ghana. We want a world of justice and humanity. And you all have done everything you can to not do that. And what we're witnessing now with this current administration is probably the exemplary example of that over the last three or four decades, even maybe longer than that, where you just, you have no sense that this government has any sense of wanting you to be taken care of, wanting you to be treated humanely, wanting you to have your dignity. And there is no Malcolm X, which is all, well, I shouldn't say there isn't. He's here, but he can't do the work that we need to do. And
well, it's up to us to do that.
Yes, that's right. And so I think that there's so many components to Malcolm, his spiritualism. I remember talking to a brother who was, had left with Malcolm, and then I can't think of his name either. Elijah Muhammad's son, who left with Malcolm and went back so he could stay alive. But
Wallace Muhammad.
Wallace, yes. And later Walrath, right?
Walrath. Walrath Dean.
And part of the thing was, I got to stay alive. My father's not going to live forever. And what Malcolm was doing was right. We need to be a part of the Muslim community, not this. You know, we need to be a part of the Muslim community. And I saw something recently where they said that that is actually the thing that, that brought so many Muslims into the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, Malcolm with his making of the Hajj, and then later on when Warith says, yeah, we're no longer that. We're lining up with the rest of the Muslim world. And again, that footprint, you know, those fingerprints of Malcolm are everywhere. It's like, yeah, we got to keep growing. We got to keep growing.
And I like that you're talking about Islam, because one of the things the last year he reads, one of his mentors has him read The Eternal Message of Muhammad. And I deal with that in The Last Revolutionary, where that book, I mean, he's sending memos to the Organization of Afro-American Unity, or initially mm-hmm. Muslim Mosque, Inc., telling them that, hey, this is the book to read. It really transforms his understanding of Islam, and Islam in that book as this very righteous religion, a peaceful religion, a religion of brotherhood and humanity. Really, really profound. And I think when you really look at him and how he's his worldview is transformed by both the eternal message of Muhammad, but also he receives two teaching certificates, mm-hmm. you really get to see that. So Malcolm becomes a Muslim imam himself. Right. He becomes a teacher. And that's really not talked about. I mean, somebody like David Du Bois, and I'd love for us to chat about this. You know, Malcolm spends the 2.5 months in Cairo. So he goes to Cairo and he's at, you know, Grappi's lemonade stand. He's doing all these things. And certainly David Du Bois writes a novel, a Roman Clef, about it, which is a brilliant book. And David Du Bois is W.E.B. Du Bois' stepson, Shirley Graham Du Bois' son, and a hugely important radical journalist who's operating out of Cairo for many years. And what's so interesting is that in those 2.5 months, Malcolm creates so many different networks that he leaves behind a Cairo chapter of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, right? Mm-hmm. And so it'd be interesting to talk about that, because I think he's really applying Pan-Africanism on the ground in a way that, you know, other people are going to try to do subsequent to him after, but I don't know how effective they are in the same way, because I really feel like Malcolm was able to meet with folks, inspire folks, learn from folks. He listened even more than he talked, even though he talked a lot, right? He listened more, if you can imagine that. So I'd love for us to talk about that.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because once he started reading in prison, his brain was turned on and it couldn't be turned off, you know, which is a phenomenal thing in itself, with the kind of calendar he had and the things he did every day, you know, traveling all over the country, different parts of the world, organizing. That's the other thing. Malcolm X is probably one of the best organizers in the Black political movement ever. You know, he could put people together and teach them and help them get to this next phase. I was looking at the picture of Amiri a while ago, you know, his meeting with Malcolm shortly before he was killed.
Amiri Baraka.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, Amiri Baraka, right. And he mentions in one of his books that he met Malcolm and King right after each other, right? Mm-hmm. Dr. King wanted to come and talk to him to understand more of the Black Power movement, and Malcolm wanted to talk to him because he was coming to Islam, but also just, you know, he understood who he was, that this is somebody who's going to really give all he had. And so there's so many components of Malcolm with this. The global part of it does not get enough attention. Mm-hmm. The spiritual part of it does not get enough attention. People tend to stop after the Nation of Islam in talking about Malcolm. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't really think about, yeah, in those short few years, he became an imam. He mm-hmm. became a global figure of Islam. And I think that's up to us. Well, certainly you're on the path. I'm going to try to catch up a little bit with some of the books I want to write.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you that because, you know, we don't have that much time left, but mm-hmm. I want to ask you, like, personally, how has Malcolm impacted you, your scholarship, your poetry, mm-hmm. And what you're trying to do at this point in your life?
Quick story. In high school, I was must have been 13, 14, because I was a year ahead. And in 1968, there was a black student organization that had been formed at my high school. And that high school, just 10 years before, it had been all white. Mm-hmm. And then there was a transition of half white, half black. And then by this time, it was all black except for a few progressive white people. And so we formed a black student union. We were going to do this Malcolm X commemoration. Actually, they were doing it. I really wasn't doing anything. And I went to the meeting. And a brother who was one of the founders and chair of it, who's also still a great friend of mine, Jeffrey Edison, he looked around the room and said, okay, so you're doing the dance, you're doing the poetry, you're doing this. And he came to me and said, Michael, what are you doing? And I said, I just came to, you know, see if I could be helpful and stuff. And he said, no, you're gonna do a speech about Malcolm's philosophy and stuff. And I was trembling, man. I was like, I had never spoken publicly before. And went home. My parents had one of Malcolm's, I think it was... It was the Ballad of the Bullet, and record player and record, right? So I'm listening to that and jotting notes down and stuff. Energy is just, I couldn't even sleep that night. And I get up there on the stage when they call me, and I got a standing ovation. And I haven't stopped since. That's awesome. That was my very first speech. And but Malcolm, because of those things we're saying, has played a huge part in my life. If I had one person to study, it would be him. Mm-hmm. It would be him. Because I think it, beyond the politics and the religion, it's just the commitment to use everything you have to be a good human being, mm-hmm. but to make the world for better for all human beings. I mean, he was just a phenomenal, phenomenal person. Loved Dr. King and those people, but their impact is different because it was sanctioned while at the same time they were trying to disrupt it, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. and committing violence against it. But I think King's belief that the United States could straighten itself up, and Malcolm didn't believe that. Mm-hmm. He was like, we have to do this work. We have to take this before the United Nations. We have to clean up ourselves. I mean, he was constantly, and then just... I really wish I had got to meet him because everybody tells me he was also, you know, like a comedic genius.
Oh, yeah. No, he's very, he had a great sense of humor. He's very funny. Right. And the charisma was off the chain, which is why for so many black men, especially, he represents a paradigm and an archetype of masculinity mm-hmm. in so many different ways. All right. My final question for you, Michael, is, you know, looking forward for the rest of the year, what can we do in terms of these 100th celebrations? There's so much stuff coming out. There's a new young children's biography about him by Ibram Kendi. Obviously, there's the Shabazz family doing a bunch of stuff in Harlem, Schomburg, other things. But what can we do in terms of celebrate this legacy, especially in the current age of this huge racial backlash, the recruitance of a really vicious kind of anti-black racism and other forms of hatred that have become really, really, really strengthened over the last, decade or mm-hmm. so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we have to kind of go back to some old habits. Like, you know, the backlash against teaching Africana studies in some of these courses or Islamic studies or whatever. We can't just be mad at that. And we have to say, okay, we're going to go to somebody's church who's progressive and say, can we teach this on Saturdays? You know, like in Florida, I was talking to a guy last year. He was like, you know, they banned books, black books in the Florida school system. I said, so what does that mean? He said, I don't know, our kids are not going to be exposed to it. And I said, no, that's not what it means. It's your job to teach it now, mm-hmm. whether it's in the basement or in the park or whatever, that we have to do that. And that has been our tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, the break with that tradition happened somewhere in the last 20 years or so. And so I think that that is primary. We have to start talking to each other. We have to start building something with each other. And in politics, the same thing. Okay, let's sit down and talk about who we want to support. What does that mean? What do we want from those people that we are electing? But we have a lot of work to do. I think we got I don't want to say complacent, but we just shifted what we thought was where we were. And to see this blatant racism mm-hmm. and violent racism against Black people and other people of color is a wake-up call for a whole generation that did not live through that.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. they weren't inoculated with what they needed to understand what is going on. Mm-hmm. And so that's our job. That is our job as scholars, as fathers and mothers, as, you know, activists, that we have to not say that what we do is dependent upon what our enemies mm-hmm. allow us to do. It mm-hmm. goes back to the thing about Malcolm in terms of dignity. That's not, they don't have the right to define us.
Yes.
They don't have the right to tell us who we are. They don't have the right to stop us from being whole human beings. And so it's going to be a hard fight because those organizations don't exist now.
Exactly. We became over-reliant on institutions, but it makes sense because of what happened to sort of this supercharged extractive monopoly capitalism mm-hmm. in as the New Deal faded, as the New Deal liberal state
right.
faded and became eviscerated. You know, and Black people did penetrate HBCUs and did penetrate some PWIs mm-hmm. like University of Texas, right?
Right.
For a time. So you come to think that model, and this happens in philanthropy and other things, will remain current, but it's being tested right now.
Yeah. And expand. Yeah. I'm sure it is. I was wondering about that when I was thinking about you on the way here. I was thinking, I wonder if he's getting pressure about what he teaches because...
You know, right now, I think everybody's getting pressure, mm-hmm. You know, because of just the political context. I think the climate, this climate shows us how an authoritarian climate can affect speech. It can affect the way in which people behave towards each other because the students feel it too, mm-hmm. whether or not they can articulate what they're feeling or not. Right. And so it's really, you know, a very, very difficult time. And like you were saying, a whole generation of people are facing it for the first time. You know? All right. So let's end it there. This has been a discussion with my friend and colleague, mentor, Dr. Michael Samanga, who's an activist, writer, and scholar who teaches Africana Studies at Morehouse College. He's former publisher of Third World Press and the current editor-in-chief of The Black Scholar. We've been talking about Malcolm X at 100 and Malcolm's legacy and the continuation of his legacy, especially in the context of the times that we're living in. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. And you can check out related content on Twitter at Peniel Joseph. That's PENIELJOSEPH. And our website, csrd.lbj.utexas.edu. And the Center for Study of Race and Democracy is on Facebook as well. This podcast was recorded at the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.